Here with the now standard Friday declamation. That was quite a week, huh? What happened the past 5 days, economy-wise? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Friday night, the day of June. It is glad, as always, to have you here. How about, just because it is a Friday, how about we take a break from the constant drumbeat of political news in this country and spend some time on the drumbeat of economic news from another country, which admittedly comes dressed up as politics. British Prime Minister Theresa May, as you've heard, is hanging on by her fingernails after the election over there yesterday. At issue, in the short term anyway, are the terms under which Great Britain is going to leave the European Union, assuming, I suppose, that Brexit still does mean Brexit. Stephen Beard is on duty at the European desk in London. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Kai.
I think we ought to start probably with a definition of terms here as to what happens now with Brexit. The hard Brexit and the soft Brexit. Discuss, would you?
Right. Well, I mean, both the main parties here, the Conservatives under Theresa May and the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn, are committed to Brexit.
Right.
May, however, has been promoting hard Brexit. She's decided the best way to get a good deal is to say, I'm pulling out of the single market, ending the free movement of EU nationals into the UK. And if we don't get that, and if we don't get a free trade deal, we'll walk away. Mm-hmm. Labour, meanwhile, is promoting a softer approach, saying we must under no circumstances walk away from the negotiating table. So this election shows there are many people in Britain that would prefer a softer Brexit. Whether they get it or not is another matter.
Yeah, well, help me understand then, Stephen, why an electorate that voted for Brexit a year ago, and granted it was close, 52-48, right? But a year ago they voted for it, and now they've denied Theresa May the stronger mandate for that Brexit.
Because her main opponent, Jeremy Corbyn, very cleverly turned this election campaign into an argument about austerity too. And he said, if we go the Theresa May route, we're going to end up with deeper cuts in public services. Hmm. And he managed to rally the support for that reason. He is the undoubted victor in this in this election, no doubt about it, even though he hasn't actually won power. And he, unsurprisingly perhaps, said Theresa May should resign.
The Prime Minister called the election because she wanted a mandate. Well, the mandate she's got is lost Conservative seats, lost votes, lost support, and lost confidence. I would have thought that's enough.
And there's probably quite a few members of her own party who might actually agree with that, because this was, after all, an election which she did not need to call. She had a majority in Parliament. She just wanted a bigger one.
Who, though, Stephen, and yes, May's job is at risk here, right? But who wants this job now?
Well, I suspect not Jeremy Corbyn, because yeah. Jeremy Corbyn is sitting very pretty now on the sidelines. He's saved his own skin because most of his own lawmakers a year ago voted to depose him. Hmm. It's a very good question. Who would want this job? Theresa May clearly wants it. She's hanging on. Whether she can survive the summer is a big question.
Cast your eyes across the English Channel, Stephen, to Europe for me for a minute. These negotiations are supposed to start in 10 days. Donald Tusk, the president of the European Council, said today, look, we don't actually know when they're going to start because of the unrest over in the UK, but we know when they're going to end. What are they doing?
Well, on the one hand, they must be rubbing their hands with glee because they can say to any country that is considering pulling out of the European Union, look at the trouble it causes. Just look across the channel at Britain. On the other hand, they've got enough problems on their plate already, and they do want to deal with Brexit. They want to get it started. However, what we're facing now because of this election result is potentially a period of pretty damaging paralysis. Because Theresa May hasn't got a stonking great majority in Parliament, many pundits here are saying May will probably face a leadership challenge pretty soon. There could even be another general election and another referendum.
Well, that's what I was just going to ask. Is it possible we're going to have another referendum on this thing and say, whoops, do over?
Yeah, it is. It is certainly possible. And it's possible that there could even be another general election, too. That would mean we would have had two referendums and three general elections in less than 3 years. Everyone, right and left, Labour and Conservative, would see that as the least appealing result of yesterday's vote.
Never a dull moment. Stephen Beard in London for us. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you, Kai.
It's worth a mention here that Brexit's a thing at all because of a miscalculation by another Conservative Prime Minister. Our partners at the BBC did a little man on the street.
David Cameron, you've got a lot to answer for. It's a fine mess you've got us into, isn't it? Because his referendum started all this off.
I'm genuinely very worried about what's going to happen to Brexit. This is the worst possible result from that point of view.
I think it leaves it uncertain of how it's going to work now, because we don't know what's going to happen, do we now?
We've got 10 days to sort it out, really, haven't we, before Brexit? So I think some people need to start pulling their fingers out from where they should be and start moving and getting this sorted.
Yeah, I don't even know what that means. Voices there from Derby and Birmingham in the UK. Another voice from Birmingham later in the program, courtesy, of course, of the BBC. On Wall Street today, just to ground it a little bit, tech companies must have gotten somebody really angry. I'll tell you what, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. I know you know this, but the British vote and its Brexit-related ramifications was only one slice of a whole bunch of news that happened this week in the global economy. To review, we've got David Gura in our New York bureau. He's at Bloomberg. Sheila Kolhatkar is there as well. She's from The New Yorker. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hi.
Gura, you won the coin toss. You get to go first. You ready? You ready?
Good. Okay, good.
All right, good. Here's the question, just quickly on Brexit. How much more chaos can one global economy stand?
Yeah, I mean, you chart this via the currency. You look at sterling weakening tremendously after the exit polls came out yesterday and the results shortly thereafter. This, suffice to say, infuses a lot of uncertainty into the situation in the UK and with Europe as well. Stephen Beard, they're mentioning about how Donald Tusk and the EU might be rubbing their hands with glee about what's going to happen here. It does certainly give them an edge. He promised a few months ago that there is going to be more cohesiveness to the European Union. I think, that, in fact, we have seen that. Since you do see a more unified Europe coming into these negotiations, I think that the threat of radical change to this government, whether or not Theresa May is replaced or whether or not she has the kind of mandate she wants, does complicate things a great deal for her government and for the UK generally.
Speaking of complicated things, Sheila, let's bring it back home. The president has had his series of news items, shall we say, about him this week. His economic agenda on Capitol Hill continues to go nowhere, I think is not a pejorative phrase.
I thought it was interesting that while everyone was very fixated on the James Comey testimony, the House of Representatives voted to essentially gut or lay in its grave the Dodd-Frank financial reform regulation. Yeah. And it's unlikely that that's really going to kind of proceed through the Senate in its form. But the Republicans have been talking about doing this for a long time. And most people who care about regulation and consumer finance protection are very concerned about, you know, what they're trying to push through. They're basically voted to eliminate the Volcker rule, which has made banks safer from speculative trading. They want to really reduce the power of the CFPB, which is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which, we can remind everyone, exposed the Wells Fargo fraud that affected many
great point,
bank customers. So the thing is, we're all very distracted by these very alarming developments around this Russia investigation. But things are happening behind the scenes that I think people need to pay attention to.
Totally agree. And David, I totally agree with what Sheila said about the Choice Act having its problems when it gets over to the Senate. However, we all said the same thing about the health care bill. And now, lo and behold, Mitch McConnell is promising a vote on health care by the 4th of July. They're putting it together in secret with no public hearings. And it's going to look a whole lot like the House bill that everybody said was dead in the Senate.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, Kai, how your infrastructure week
I love infrastructure week,
White House,
right? Yeah, which is what this was at the White House, yeah.
Yeah, the White House christened that over the weekend, and we saw a movement away from that over the course of the week. Yeah, the president's
away,
still
great.
Adamant. Yeah, there you go, putting that charitably. Republicans, the White House, saying that the agenda is still intact despite what we saw yesterday before the Senate Intelligence Committee. There's a lot of distraction on Capitol Hill. I think that what we saw yesterday at that hearing doesn't do much to allay that. I think the open question is what happens to that House bill that was voted upon. The health care that was voted upon, bill that was voted upon. And now you have the Senate sort of hashing it out. Yes, it's being done in secrecy. I think there's a lot of pessimism about What's going to happen with that and to the Financial Choice Act that Sheila was talking about just a moment ago? You wonder sort of what component parts of that are going to live on when, by all accounts, that bill, if voted upon in the Senate, doesn't pass.
Sheila, with my usual caveat here that the Dow Jones is not the economy and the economy is not the Dow, it is somewhat staggering that with all, somewhat staggering, he says, that with all this chaos, traders and corporate America seem to be doing just fine. Thank you very much.
Yes. Well, I think people have become a little weary almost of trying to explain the behavior of the market and of certain groups of investors, because it is baffling when you look at it from the outside. There is so much chaos and uncertainty and distraction and threat of prosecutions and bills that are falling apart and that can't go anywhere. All of the reasons we heard to be optimistic about sort of stock prices, which largely drive the big indices, you know, tax cuts, for one thing, reducing regulation, all sorts of things that were supposed to benefit people who own stocks. A lot of that is taking much, much longer than anyone expected. And meanwhile, we are seeing these wild gyrations in the sort of political environment, both here and with Brexit and in other countries around the world. So we would really expect the market to be reflecting a lot more of that uncertainty. Generally, the market does not like uncertainty. It likes nice, predictable outcomes that people can kind of build their investments around. And we don't have that. And there are some prominent market watchers kind of sounding the alarm and expressing concern. And one recent one this week was Bill Gross, who who's been in the market for a long time. And he said, you know, this reminds me of 2008.
So there's
reason to worry.
Gura, very quickly, Janet Yellen and the Fed meet Tuesday, Wednesday. Give me five words. Janet Yellen's thoughts. Five words or less. Go. Give me five words. Only five.
I'm going to count.
Who is going to be on the Fed next? That's too many letters. Who's going to join me here?
Oh, that's a good one, because there are some vacancies and there's talk of the president making
a lot of personnel change in the works. Yeah.
All right. David Gura at Bloomberg. I messed up my own poll, by the way. I messed up my own game. David Gura at Bloomberg. Sheila Kolhatkar at The New Yorker. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Thank you.
Have a good weekend. What is normal? What is not? How to make sense of the latest headlines? Me and Molly Wood on the latest episode of our podcast, Make Me Smart. You can listen, subscribe, tell your friends. Marketplace.org/makemesmart. Check it out. We didn't get too deep into it, Sheila Gura and I, mostly because I messed up my own game. But the Fed meets on Tuesday with interest rates, as always, on the agenda. There's a lot going on when the Fed talks monetary policy, of course. The unemployment rates, worker productivity, how fast the economy is growing or not. Right at the tippy top of that list, though, is inflation. For more than 20 years, the Fed has had an inflation North Star of sorts, a target that helps guide it, to torture the metaphor just a little bit, of keeping inflation right around 2%. Now, though, a group of prominent economists and activists is arguing that time has come to rethink that number. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains what's going on.
In 1996, when the economy was great, the Federal Reserve and lots of other central banks were thinking about what level of inflation would be best for the economy.
Rather arbitrarily, they picked 2%.
Sebastian Malaby is a historian who studied the Federal Reserve. The Fed wanted to keep prices stable, but they weren't quite sure whether they were measuring inflation correctly.
There was no consensus really on a kind of objective reason why it should be 2% as opposed to 1% or 3%.
They just went with 2%. Who cares? It's fine. Everything is fine. Except the Fed has learned when it's not fine, when things go terribly wrong in the economy. Jason Furman is with the Peterson Institute.
Having that target today just leaves you less room.
Less room to lower interest rates, which are affected by inflation. Like during the Great Recession, the Federal Reserve lowered rates until rates basically went to zero. Furman and other economists argue that if we had a higher inflation rate to begin with, it would be like having a fatter brake pad on the economy. The Fed would have had more space to lower both inflation and interest rates. Joe Stiglitz, economist at Columbia University, argues this would also help workers.
When we run a tighter economy that's associated with a higher inflation rate, wages rise faster than inflation, and the share of labor increases. Workers do better because there's a tight labor market.
On the other hand, higher inflation does have a cost.
You get to 3 or 4% inflation, I don't think you can call that stable prices anymore.
Don Cohn is with the Brookings Institution. He says inflation can interfere with businesses and individuals trying to make sense of the prices and costs they see as they go about their everyday lives. Still, he says the 2% number needs a good rethink.
We need to talk about this issue.
But there are just a few other things going on in Washington right now that may just be distracting everyone's attention. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Coming up.
What does that mean in terms of government policy, in terms of the UK leaving Europe?
Good questions, both. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 89 points on this Friday, 0.4%, 21,271. NASDAQ down 113 points, 1.8%, 6207. The S&P 500 off 2 points, nearly a 10%, 24.31 for the week. The Dow added 0.3%, the NASDAQ off about 1.5%. Most of that today, as you can see, the S&P 500 down 0.3%. We've been discussing Theresa May's poor performance in the UK election. The pound took its own beating, down 1.75% against the dollar. That, in turn, lifted up the UK stock exchange. The FTSE 100 jumped 1% today. Satellite radio company SiriusXM said if it couldn't acquire the online music service Pandora, it would buy 19% of the thing for $480 million. Investors thus did a happy dance, boosting Pandora's shares 6% before ending up just 1.1%. Sirius shares down about 3.7%. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.20%. And you are listening to Marketplace. Hi, everybody. It's Kai Rizdahl. Marketplace is here because these days it's essential to have an independent source explaining how the economy really works, not just for CEOs, but for everybody. Your support keeps this kind of reporting coming, and it's especially vital now at the end of our fiscal year. So please visit marketplace.org/donate to contribute and to keep us in your world every day. And thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. If you are a crazy Taylor Swift fan, you probably already know what I'm about to say. Should you not be a crazy Taylor Swift fan? I get it. Really, I do. But what happened is that as of today, her music catalog is back on Spotify and the other big streaming services. Swift had pulled her music from Spotify in 2014, saying that the company didn't pay artists fairly. Marketplace's Aaron Schrank has more.
It's only been 3 years since she left Spotify, but to borrow from a now streamable Taylor Swift track, everything has changed. What's changed exactly? Well, Spotify has given Taylor some of what she wants. The company has agreed to let her distributor, Universal Music Group, do something called windowing. Catherine Moore teaches music technology at the University of Toronto.
Where you say to fans, okay, if you're a free user of this service, you have to wait 2 weeks. But if you're a premium, and we want you to be a premium subscriber, you'll get it right away.
Windowing is good for labels and artists because they earn way more money from paid users than from unpaid ones. And now artists realize streaming isn't going anywhere. Larry Miller directs the music business program at NYU.
If you want people to listen to you, you need to be where the people are.
When 1989 came out, Spotify had 10 million users. Now 50 million people use the service, and
more than half of the revenues collected by the recorded music industry come from the streaming services.
Streaming has become a powerful marketing tool. Artists like Kanye, Beyonce, and Rihanna all released exclusive streams of their albums before the physical vinyl or CD. And Chance the Rapper managed to win a Grammy this year without putting out any kind of physical album. Despite its leading position in the streaming field, Spotify is expected to be making more concessions to the big record labels in the near future. There's a particular reason for that, says Karen Allen, a digital entertainment consultant.
They are going up for an IPO. They have to play ball, basically.
There may be another reason behind the timing of Taylor's announcement. Katy Perry, with whom she's rumored to have a long-standing beef, has a new album out today. Coincidence? I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
About a year ago, a couple of weeks after the original Brexit vote, the BBC sent a reporter to Birmingham, England, to talk to the guy who runs the company that makes this.
This whistle is the Acme Thunderer.
It is, in fact, the Acme Whistle Company that makes the Acme Thunderer. Simon Topman is the managing director. We've called him up to see what is what post-election. Simon, welcome to the program.
Hi.
Well, here we are the next day, as it were. What's your gut telling you about this election?
Well, it's telling me, like all businessmen who want security and comfort of knowing exactly where they are, it's telling me that I don't. A hung parliament, what does that mean in terms of government policy, in terms of the UK leaving Europe? Heavens, it really is an up-in-the-air situation. And if this election was called to solve some of those problems, it certainly did the opposite.
Let's talk about some of the issues you face running the Acme Whistle Company. As we said in that piece that aired last year after the Brexit vote, something like 40% of your product goes over to Europe. How worried are you now about hard versus soft Brexit and all of that?
Temporarily, the pound has fallen because of all the uncertainty. And that, of course, is very good for me because it means my product prices overseas are going down. However, that's just the short term. The fact of the matter is, we no longer know, if we ever did, exactly what sort of negotiation is going to go on between the UK and Europe. But what I am sure of is it will take a longer time to sort out than might otherwise have been the case. The politicians have got to get their act together, and until they do, there ain't going to be nothing happening.
Have you spoken to your European suppliers and or customers today?
Yes. Some of them are quite happy, and as a sneaking little bit of happiness in me too, because it could well be, and certainly my European distributors are hoping, they don't want us to leave at all in reality, and if the deal can be a little bit closer and a little bit better and a little bit softer, they are happy. And so am I, really, because we are Europeans at the end of the day, and for us to fall out with Europe isn't a good idea in business terms.
We're speaking to you late afternoon, England time. What's the word on the shop floor been today?
Well, the thing that bothers them most, I'll tell you, most of my employees is immigration. Because there is a big feeling here in the UK that we have too many immigrants. However, half my factory workers on the shop floor are immigrants of one kind or another. The workers don't get it, really. They are worried about trying to get an appointment with the doctor, trying to get your children into school, that we'll be flooded with immigrants who will take all those places and they'll be pushed out, when the truth of the matter is we need those workers because we aren't generating them ourselves. And if, as a result of leaving Europe with a bad deal and the immigration has to stop, business will find it very, very difficult to cope with that.
One more question about uncertainty. The Prime Minister does seem to have survived for now, but that's clearly up in the air. How worried are you about more domestic political upheaval and the Acme Whistle Company?
I'm sure that there will be lots, and I don't like the idea of it. Who knows what regulations could ensue, what tax policies could ensue. There's one thing I do know, is in a long life of whistle-making, whenever I've seen political turmoil, I've never seen taxes go down or business do better. So it does concern me, I can tell you.
Simon Topman, the managing director of the Acme Whistle Company in Birmingham, England. Thank you, sir, so much for your time.
Thanks for having me on the show.
This final note on the way out today, back to where we started yesterday, actually. You might remember I said political theater makes for good television. Well, it really, really, really does. The ratings are in for James Comey's testimony yesterday. 19.4 million people tuned in for all or part of the three-hour hearing. That's about the same as the amount that tuned in for game one of the NBA Finals this year. Today in history, by the way, to pick up my recent Twitter thread of history rhyming at really interesting times. June the 9th, 1954. The two-month-long Army McCarthy hearings came to a head with the famous At Long Last, Sir, Have You No Decency session. Yes, fine. I was a history major. All right, we are done of a Friday afternoon. The Dow up 89 points today, about 0.4%. NASDAQ down 113. That is 1.8%. S&P 500 down 0.2%, 2431. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rosdahl. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. We will be back on Monday, all right? This is APM.